Hi, welcome to this month's episode of the Cure Talks Cancer Podcast, Nursing Edition. Once a month, sister publications Oncology Nursing News and Cure Magazine will come together for a podcast on topics that will affect both cancer survivors and oncology nurses. For today's episode, we'll be discussing a topic that impacts the entirety of healthcare, but also plays an important role in cancer care, health equity. We had the chance to speak with Chastity M. Washington, director of the Center for Cancer Health Equity at The Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center, on the importance of health equity in the workplace and why nurses need to factor in the social determinants of health when treating their patients.
Social determinants of health, again, are those factors that influence a person's health outside of the clinical setting. So it could be things like economic situations, education, resources, insurance. So I think a lot of times by the time patients are in the treatment stage, nurses and clinicians feel that those issues have already been addressed by social workers or financial counselors. So I always like to encourage nurses to use the tool that we have through the National Comprehensive Cancer Network. So the distress thermometer, and people usually use the distress thermometer part, but there's also a problem list for patients. And I think that gets ignored a lot of times because, again, as even if issues were addressed when the patient was first diagnosed or first seen, things change during their journey, their cancer journey. Job situations change, support systems change. And I think just checking in with those things and using that problem list that's out there is one way that they could do that and just check in with the patient. The list asks things about practical problems or family problems, emotional problems, as well as the physical problems. And I think a lot of times we focus on, you know, stress levels and physical problems, but we don't tune into sort of those, do you have housing issues? Has your insurance changed? Your transportation to the appointments, has that changed? And are there other issues that perhaps that we could be of assistance and reconnect you with the social worker or other resources? So I think that's one key thing that nurses can tune into. Again, looking at those things outside of the clinical visit that impact their patients, either adherence or just being able to support them in that journey.
So you had mentioned a number of the determinants and things for nurses to kind of check up on throughout the process. So I was wondering, is there any social determinant in particular that you think really impacts patients the most, or one that nurses can easily hone in on before maybe they have to go back to the social worker or the financial counselor for a little more like expertise aid?
Financial is always huge. Financial toxicity related to the cancer care. So it's beyond just even the insurance coverage and just being able to connect them to other resources that may exist. Sometimes there's internal resources and patient support funds that patients aren't aware of. And then again, external resources as well that patients can be connected to, even for small things. I mean, I think sometimes we think that it needs to be some big financial contribution, but we've had places that give resources to patients as small as $100, and you'd be surprised what a patient can do with that $100 that will improve home life, their situation, and help them sort of even just get food or keep the lights on or keep the heat on in the winter. Those things can be of great assistance. So I always would say start with your social workers, and sometimes social workers actually have a Google Drive or a Doc Drive that you could get access to that lists all those resources. There's usually a 211, either a website, which is you can go in and put in, I think even down to the zip code level, and they can show you resources that are available by category, whether it be housing or food pantries, and so it will list by zip code all those resources for a patient, and you can even refer patients to that resource as well. The American Cancer Society has a website where you can go in and do the same thing and put in where you're at and what you're interested in, and they will show you where support groups are or where is a wig bank or certain classes that they have that like Look Good, Feel Better, where they help women, again, with wigs and makeup and sort of that self-esteem while they're going through treatment and maybe hair loss and other things. So you can use those sorts of resources. Those are sort of the big ones that we use. And then most states have a benefit bank, so you can also find your benefit bank and go through. There's a training, and there's also just a site where you could see what resources are available in the area.
Something that we had talked about in our interview at SONO was the implicit bias test. And so I was wondering if you could discuss maybe where nurses can take that test and then maybe where nurses can look to resources to help them educate themselves based on the results of that test.
Yeah, so there's probably several different tests out there, but the one that I like and I think has been around the longest is done by Harvard, and it's implicit.harvard.edu, and you could just Google Harvard implicit bias test, and it will take you to that site, and they have several. So there's one about race, ethnicity, women, men, religion. So there's ones about LGBTQ population. So you can take any test, and then it will give you, again, like I said in my presentation, the result of whether or not you have a bias towards any of these people, conditions, whatever test that you take. And then, again, just because you have that bias, it's, again, not, doesn't mean that you're racist, just what it says. It's implicit. It's something that you probably aren't even aware of, and that's the point of taking the test, because you wouldn't otherwise know if you didn't take the test. Yeah. And there's plenty of resources out there. There's web classes that have been created by, I think, Oncology Nursing Society, the National Medical Association. There's all sorts of different cultural competency classes and things that are available. So I think just looking at what's available from those credible sources, as well as I know a lot of times hospitals and institutions have their own trainings. They're usually not mandatory, which so again, if that is something that's available as a resource, then look into taking those. And then what we like to say is, even outside of that, some of the things that we can do immediately based on those results are just looking for something in common with patients. So if you find out you have an implicit bias towards Muslim patients, then maybe the next time you have a patient that comes in and maybe it's a woman in a hijab, and then start trying to find something in common with that patient, whether it be some kind of food or someplace you've been in common. I think that helps with those biases. And then, again, thinking about someone maybe that if you have a negative association towards something, thinking about someone who proves the opposite of that. So even if it's a celebrity or a famous person, just thinking about that person or individual that sort of counters whatever negative stereotype or opinion that you may have about a group, I think those are things you can sort of do mentally on your own, start doing those right away. And then I think just considering the opposite. So that's sort of the same vein of finding someone that counters the stereotype that you may have in your brain, is consider the opposite. So if you think one thing about a group subconsciously, or it's been brought to light through the test, then, well, what if the opposite is true?
What's something that an individual nurse can do to kind of call the attention, hey, we need this training, or we need to make this training mandatory instead of just non-mandatory?
So I think, yeah, that's exactly sort of where the idea of a champion came from. So from our experience, like if you even start having the dialogue about, you know, what can we do, those individuals usually kind of just turn up. You can tell who's going to be passionate about it, who's interested in it, who's maybe had experience with it in another capacity, even if it's not in their current position. They sort of just show up if you put it out there. So as far as the institution finding a champion, I think just having the discussion, the people will come to the surface who are interested. But then once they are showing their interest, then you have to give them sort of the power and the resources to be that champion. So when we've done this work before, like I said, we've usually had people that just kind of naturally rise to the occasion, and then they've been given sort of authority to say, you know, they're going to be the champion. If any staff person hears or sees anything, you can share that with, you know, this person. If there's anything you're interested in, you can go to this person, and then they would then communicate that. So, like, there's a need. You know, staff really want to learn about, you know, end-of-life care and rituals for this group, or they want to know about issues within the LGBTQ community that, you know, that we could address in our clinic. So then that person would then go to the powers that be and maybe even do some research on their own to find out who provides these sort of trainings and what's out there, and then they would present that, and then that would then happen within the clinic or location. We've been really fortunate in a couple of instances where we've had a nurse who used to be an oncology nurse and now does sort of nurse staff training. So she was already involved in the training and education of nurses. So that was sort of a win-win, and she's partnered with us, and we've helped connect them to resources. And she brings those trainings in on an ongoing basis for staff. But another thing you could do is if you have staff take the IAT test, the implicit bias test, and again, it can be totally anonymous, and they don't necessarily have to report their results, but maybe have them take it and send in a list of, you know, topics that they would like to have a training on, and then go through those and whatever the top issues or concerns, then look and see who does training on that and have those come in and be addressed. So I think as far as if a nurse themselves wanted to be the champion, I think just presenting that, I mean, in even talking amongst peers, I think a lot of times people will share with each other issues and things that are brought up, but maybe not always bring those to management just because they don't think they can do anything about it. But again, if you give them that power and say, if you bring these to us, we'll do the best that we can to address them and give you the resources and tools to handle that, because we value diversity not only in staff but in our patients, and we want to make sure that we're providing the best care to everyone. I think that gives not only the champion the power, but then the rest of the staff the same sort of comfort in bringing those issues and talking about those things. Like I said, not only with patients, but then even within the staff themselves, because a lot of times we have different cultures and identities within staff that we should also recognize and celebrate. So I think it can do multiple things. If you could have people in the workspace that represent everyone, that would be great. It doesn't necessarily mean that they have to treat that particular individual, but they could also be that voice that helps the rest of the staff with issues or concerns. But yes, if you could have someone from a diverse population providing care to those patients, it's nice. But again, it's not always necessary, as long as that the culture within the system allows for that support and that training and that sensitivity, and then you have sort of a support person or a resource person to run that through. However, there is a shortage of healthcare providers in general, and then those of color and from other communities, it's even smaller. So I think one of the things I talked about before was to address these health disparities and these social determinants of health, we can't just stay within the hospital. We need to go out. We need to be partnering with the community. We need to be addressing these issues in any way that we can. So one of the things I said was maybe reaching out to marginalized communities or sort of public schools and people of color, and seeing that, you know, what their interest is in nursing or oncology, and are there any programming that we can do with schools to encourage that within different populations, and being mentors. And so I know some places have adoptive schools, and they do STEM programming, and they do a doctor for a day or a nurse for a day. So could we look at doing sort of some of those sort of things to increase the workforce? And then, of course, yes, making sure that we're thinking about that when we're hiring people. You know, are there people, are we recruiting for this position in channels where we would reach people of color that would have this degree or this skill set? So I think that's of benefit as well, because then as you have those people as part of your culture, that helps then create a culture of diversity as well, because they're already looking through that lens of diversity for whatever culture and population they represent.
With that, how much implicit biases and social determinants can just affect the workplace in general, how can it impact patients when they're looking to enter clinical trials?
Yeah, so sort of like self-selection. Sometimes providers won't ask a certain individual to participate, and it may not, like I said, may not be flat out because of a racist thing. Like I said, it's implicit bias. So again, going back to what an implicit bias is, it's something that we've learned, or it's internal. It's not something we're consciously aware of, and it's based on our past experiences and sort of things that prime us. So in the medical world, if you review a patient's chart and you see that they've no-showed, or they've been non-compliant with medication, or whatever is in that note, then it helps you form an opinion of that patient. If you read research and it says, oh, well, minorities don't participate in clinical trials and they have mistrust and all these things, it may be in your subconscious when you're talking to these patients. And it takes a lot to put a patient on a clinical trial. And then a lot of times if they have comorbidities that aren't uncontrolled and they have to get under control before they can enroll, all those sort of things in the back of our mind may just have us self-select the patient out. And not, again, not because of anything negative or purposely trying to discriminate against that patient, usually because we're thinking, oh, well, I know they have trouble getting here. If they go on this study, they may have extra visits, or, oh, I'm not sure, you know, if their insurance will cover it, or all these things that in our mind we may be thinking we're being helpful or know the response to the patient, and then we don't ask. And there's a lot of studies that say if you ask patients, particularly patients of color, and you explain it and you explain the benefit of the study, then they will actually go on the study. So again, just looking at those sort of things that, you know, we've learned and we've seen historically, but then countering those, like we said before, well, this may not always be the case. And so why did they no-show to their appointment? Was it because they set up transportation through their insurance and the transportation didn't show? Why were they not adherent to taking their medication? Was it that they didn't get the medication that when it was being delivered? We actually had a situation where we had a woman who couldn't hear, and her medication was being delivered to her home, and then she wasn't taking it. And we had a community health worker that was working in that community and realized that the reason she wasn't taking her medication was because she wasn't getting it, because it was being delivered and you have to sign for it. And she did not have the visual doorbell. So when the UPS man was coming with the prescription, you know, he would ring the doorbell and she would never answer and he couldn't leave it. And so we got doorbell installed where she could see the light, and then of course she would get her medicine and took it. So now she's compliant. Where, again, we don't always know the reasons behind why patients do things, but if we then take that and internalize it, we can then, again, have implicit biases and exclude these patients without really knowing all the things behind it. And it may be if you had patient navigators, if there's things and barriers to patients participating, working with that navigator, and then they would, again, be compliant and participate in the study. So just sort of thinking outside the box and making sure that we ask everyone, regardless of whether we think they'll be able to comply or be adherent, and sort of then having those discussions with the patients and would there be a barrier and what can we do to address those barriers.